Always record 176.
But isn't June 16th an important day in both the novel and in Joyce's life with Nora?
Yes. This is something a lot of Joyce scholars skate around nervously. They say June 16th was the day Joyce and Nora went for a walk together for the first time. Actually, as Joyce's letters to Nora in 1909, when she was still in Trieste and he went back to Dublin temporarily to open a movie theater, which he thought would make him rich, and he got cheated by his partners. June 16th, what actually happened is they walked on Sandy Mount Strand and Joyce made sexual advances and she gave him a hand job. So every year as Bloomsday gets bigger and bigger and leads to more and more tourist trade and enriches pious Catholic Ireland more and more, they are all celebrating a hand job, whether they know it or not. I think the hand job was so important to Joyce because, based on all the biographical work that's been published so far, it was the first time in his whole life that he had an orgasm with a woman without paying for it. His whole sex life up until then had been entirely with prostitutes. Suddenly, he was a woman who, out of sheer kindness and love, was willing to give him what he needed, an orgasm, a relief from sexual tension, whatever you want to call it. He fell in love with her, and he stayed in love with her for the rest of his life.
All right. Let me tell you how the 42 minutes works. I read a short introduction. I start a clock, and we go for 42 minutes and arrive at the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. Are you guys up for it?
I'm down.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Oh, this book, I tell you what. All right, so then if you guys are ready, we'll just launch into this thing.
I should say hi to Dennis. I haven't talked to you before. Nice to
yeah, to you. Great pleasure. I was just thinking about something I read on your blog years ago and reading it again. So.
Oh, right on.
And Dennis, I believe we spoke in passing once or twice. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Yes, we have, and I don't know. I have been listening to some old Always Records, and you did such a fantastic job. You forget how good some of those conversations were, and yeah. Well, anyways, let's play this game.
All right. All right. What time is it? All right. Everyone in my house needs to be quiet, okay? Please, everyone. Because I'm doing a show, high profile. It's a big deal. Well, thanks. I don't even feel like we even scratch this thing. No, you know? No. It's like we have this elephant in another room and it's completely in the dark and we haven't even approached the room yet. We can't even talk about this thing. I don't even know how to talk about this thing.
We could we could get deeper into it. I kind of want to talk about the since it is 42 minutes or it was 42 minutes, talk about the coincidence side of it, which is that's huge in itself, you know. I can start with something from this is a biography by Richard Ellman, the big biography on James Joyce, and this is something interesting about Joyce's take on synchronicity, or he calls it coincidence. Joyce's fictional method does not presume that the artist has any supernatural power, but that he has an insight into the methods and motivations of the universe. Samuel Beckett has remarked that to Joyce, reality was a paradigm, an illustration of a possibly unstatable rule. Yet perhaps the rule can be surmised. It is not a perception of order or of love. More humble than either of these, it is the perception of coincidence. According to this rule, reality, no matter how much we try to manipulate it, can only assume certain forms. The roulette wheel brings up the same numbers again and again. Everyone and everything shift about in continual movement, yet movement limited in its possibilities. Joyce was interested in variation and sameness in time. Bloom consoles himself with the thought that every betrayal is only one of an infinite series. If someone mentioned a new atrocity to Joyce, he at once pointed out some equally horrible old atrocity, such as an act of the Inquisition in Holland. And then it goes on. But I thought that was excellent, you know, that it's the perception of coincidence that he's talking about. That's his whole paradigm. That's what reality is.
You know, I've known and loved that quote for years, and I first encountered it in the writings of Robert Anton Wilson. And for many years, I started to distrust some things that Wilson throws out there, because I don't know the level of his tricksterism, you know, especially with the people that he knows and loves and respects and quotes. So it's nice to know that that quote is actually a real thing, because not that it would change much, but I've just based so much my perspective on that line itself.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Like, here's one. Okay, here's a coincidence that I found this time, like a big one. Like, in that quote, he's talking about it talks about disasters. If someone mentioned a new atrocity to Joyce, he had once pointed out some equally horrible old atrocity. Well, here's one. Okay, so in Ulysses, in the book Ulysses, it's obviously it's June 16th, but in June 15th. There was this massive disaster in New York City where the General Slocum steamboat was sank. Yeah, and there was a big fire on it, and like 1,000 people died. It was the biggest. This is the whole thing. It was the biggest disaster in New York since 9/11. So right before Bloomsday, there was an equivalent to a 9/11 that happened.
Well, and then we're having real life, the fire in London.
I know.
Mirrors that exact same thing on the eve of Bloomsday. Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was amazing. So there's certain references through Ulysses to this General Slocum disaster, riverboat disaster.
Mm. You know, as far as coincidences with Joyce, it definitely feels once you put the Joyce lens on, it's kind of with you forever. But when we were talking about the construction of Ulysses, I know that Robert Anton Wilson was obsessed with counting the coincidences in the text of Ulysses itself, noting that there are like over 100 different coincidences. And I don't have that kind of literature or literati lens to be able to discern that from the text itself. That's an element to it that is just blind to me, right? I can't see it. So I am, but to them, it's absolutely clear, right? It's crystal clear. And so they can gain the energetic from those epiphanies in the text itself, right? They've noticed them, they've felt them, they've had that transference between reader and text, right? So it is a good mirror for those people who are in your lives who have absolutely no idea why you get so excited about sync or synchronicity or coincidence, right?
Right.
It's almost as if I can read the text of reality thanks to it's almost like it's like a gym or a gymnasium where you work out the muscles for recognizing coincidence. And that the effort poured into Joyce has maybe not elicited the returns from the text itself, but I've been able to elicit those returns from my surroundings. And so my failure to interact with the text, I gain an empathy for people around me who don't have that sort of sixth sense that I feel like I carry all the time. It sort of humbled me in a certain way.
Yeah. It's just a few days ago, like anticipating this call, I went to an online, there's an online concordance of Ulysses or something like that, and I wanted to find out how many times the word coincidence is mentioned in Ulysses, and it's actually there's 12 times. Yeah, 12 times.
Really?
Where the word is mentioned. The actual word is mentioned, and then on top of it, there's like, yeah, there's coincidence upon coincidence all the way through it, right? Like the whole book is structured on a coincidence. It's the coincidence of Leopold Bloom meeting Stephen Dedalus, which is like a father looking for a son meeting a son who's looking for a father. And the whole book kind of, it's another word that keeps coming up is there's a word that Bloom says is kismet, which is like Turkish or something for destiny. So if you think of it, they met, Stephen and Bloom meet in that hospital scene, that really key scene, but they only meet because Leopold had a chance meeting with this old girlfriend who told him about this woman, Mina Purfoy, who's having a kid at the, who's trying to have a baby at the hospital. And then he decides to go there. And so that's the only reason why he was able finally to meet Stephen. So there's that kind of coincidence. There's that kind of level of coincidence where just as you go through your day, just meeting somebody, you know, like you just happen to meet somebody, like even you meet somebody at work or somebody or on your way to work or whatever, like that kind of stuff happens all the time. It's sort of commonplace, but in a way it's deeply significant. If you look at it afterwards, it's almost like somebody was writing your day, you know, like writing the narrative of your day. Like I was really paying attention to that on my Friday, like yesterday, which was Bloom's day here. Just all the kind of so-called chance meetings that I had just with people in my day. And when you look at it afterwards, it's like, it doesn't seem much like chance at all, you know. It's almost as if every point in your day happens to be a coincidence.
Well, I work in a retail situation in my day job, and I find it interesting that there's almost an energy that different people attract, because the kind of I see people get bogged down with certain customers, and I don't necessarily I don't get those. It's almost like there's this, it's in the same realm as this coincidence, but there's something about, you'd have to call it the law of attraction, or, you know, you're calling out for something, you know, like energy vampires or whatever it is. But it seems like, you know, the kind of experiences that I have are not the kind of experiences that some of my colleagues have. You know, it's like,
right.
I don't have those experiences. So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because, I mean, it does speak to this idea of coincidence, but it does seem that oftentimes we're the stars of our own life with our own set of characters, like, that are for us expressly.
Yeah. This is something that Joseph Campbell talks about, like, and he's talking about Schopenhauer, using Schopenhauer's work, is that, and when we reflect upon our life at the end of our life, it's almost as if it's constructed as well as a dream is constructed, where all these characters enter in and out of your dream, and you wake up and you think, how did I do that? How did I create that in my mind? It's impossible, you know? But our lives are like that, you know? And then if you combine that with the idea that comes with Ulysses of metempsychosis.
Now, I missed that. What, tell me about, isn't there metempsychosis and metempsychosis?
Yeah, well, that's Molly Bloom's mispronunciation of the word, or misunderstanding of the word, right? So Bloom talks about metempsychosis, and then she interprets it as what? What did you say? Met him pike hoses, which is obviously what she's going to do afterwards with a
Boylan. Okay. What is his name? It's
Blazes Boylan.
What a great name.
Great name.
Yeah. He's blazing. Yeah. And then, but metempsychosis is, it's kind of the Greek philosophical term for reincarnation, right? And so the Bloom is Ulysses, right? And Stephen is Telemachus, and Blazes Boylan is he represents the suitors, like the 108 suitors that come to try to steal Penelope away from Ulysses while he's gone.
Did you say 108? Is it really 108 suitors?
Yeah, yeah. Traditionally, it's 108, which is that's a huge thing too, right?
Yeah.
And that's not it's not directly mentioned in Ulysses, but it's there. You can find it. He at one point in the the second last chapter, which kind of it's written in the style of a Catholic catechism, where there's a question given, like a really crazy in-depth question, and then this even crazier answer. There's a figure in there that they give. It's actually kind of Kabbalistic, because they're talking about different numerical values of Hebrew and then Gaelic letters. And then one of them works out to be, what is it, 3 and 1 and 4 and 100, which is 108, yeah? And so that's the direct reference there to the 108 suitors, which this is what I flew off on, because, of course, 1904 is the year that the Age of Horus starts, according to Crowley. And then if we add 108 years to that, which is this Rosicrucian cycle that comes in, if we had to add 108 years to that, then we come up with 2012.
Was in that blog entry, correct?
Yeah, so that's my own insanity about Ulysses. I think it's really tied in with what Crowley is doing, and what people like the poet Yeats are doing, and what Ezra Pound is doing, and D.H. Lawrence is doing, and the poet H.D. is doing. Like, they're all talking about this new era that's coming about, right? And Joyce was right in the thick of that, even though he doesn't talk about it directly. But you can tell from his writings that it's all there, you know.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting about him having written this book in Trieste, because that was the name of the submarine that held the world's record for the deepest depth for a long time. And then there you have Crowley, who's also a mountaineer, climbing it to a really high height. And I think that is interesting, because we're talking about people that are projecting that are physically going to outside of the plane that we're on. And this also, you mentioned the physical body earlier, and I think it's about feeling into, you can see, like me and my friend Kurt Hardesty, we were having a long discussion earlier about how feeling and seeing into parts of your physical body allow you certain types of insight or vision or whatever about the script that we're seeing outside of our body, because, right. You know, and so I don't know. And also the thing about Trieste that I found really interesting is that at one point, so here Joyce has this back history and all this content related to Catholicism that he's both mocking as well as, you know, referencing his own youth with as a altar boy and stuff. But and the papacy at one point almost relocated to Trieste in 1929. So it's just, I don't know. It's one of those things that it's like the path. He relocated to Trieste himself. So I don't know. And then that's a city that has a very interesting, it has a super collider there of modern note. But it was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then it became a part of Italy. So it's a location itself that's very, I've spent some time in Croatia, and my friend Talitha Wall spent some time in Trieste. So it's all that Dalmatian coast there. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's huge, because, like 1904 is also the year he became an exile too, right? And so in a way, all of his writings I think we talked, maybe Doug talked about this earlier, is that it, all of his writings reflect on that, his life as an Irish exile, right? As a Ulysses in himself, like as somebody who's really trying to get home. But it's not, the problem is that he's trying to get home, he's trying to get back to Ireland, but he doesn't like the Ireland that he wants to get back to, you know. But then there's a problem, right? So, and this kind of gets into an interesting political discussion as well. Like, it really, really sort of pertinent to what's going on now. It's like, so you get the Cyclops episode, and he meets this rabid kind of Sinn Féin nationalist, the Citizen, in this bar, and the Citizen is completely against the British Empire, which Joyce was as well, right? But then at the same time, he's really for strong Irish nationalism and completely xenophobic, like anti-Semitic and all of this other stuff, which Joyce was totally against, right? And so the Ireland that Joyce is wanting to go back to is something between those two extremes, between the kind of Scylla and Charybdis of those two extremes. And you see the two extremes in place today, you know, like the American Empire or even globalism or whatever you want to call it. And then you have this resurgent kind of xenophobic nationalism, right? And both should be equally avoided, you know. And at the moment, there's almost nobody out there who's rejecting both extremes, you know. You know, nobody vocal anyways, yeah.
Well, you don't need to be vocal if you're rejecting it.
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah, it's true. You just drop out. That's another thing Joyce said is use your cunning and what do you say, cunning and just stay back from the action, you know. But eventually they come for you. Like in the Cersei episode, he gets mixed up with these two British soldiers who end up hitting him, and he's not meaning anything. It's like he's Stephen Dedalus is drunk on the street, and these guys are accusing him of coming onto this girl, and then Stephen mentions something like, "I have to kill the king and the priest in my head," and then the British soldier is like, "What did you say against our king?"
Yeah.
But that's the level of it, you know. That's what the level of discourse is even now, you know. It's like Joyce is talking about something else. He's talking about the kind of the artist, right? The individual artist who's like equally against empire and against nationalism, right? More of a universalist than anybody else, but equally faithful to himself or herself as an individual, as an artistic, creative individual. It's a voice that needs to be heard, you know.
Which is amazing, because when the book was released, you couldn't buy it legally in any English-speaking country.
Mm. Yeah, only in Europe.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, because it seems like, the thing people think about this is that it's such an obscene book. And I wouldn't say that, I mean, there are parts that are, I mean, express humanity, but it's, I wouldn't say it's particularly obscene.
Well, this is where that Frank Delaney really makes some really interesting, because he's breaking down like what specifically he's parodying within mass at various, and it's, I mean, if you were to read it on that level, I think, I mean, I was curious about that too, Doug. Like, why was this considered such? But like,
One thing to keep in mind is that it became legal in the States in the exact same week as Prohibition was brought down in the States. So that's like a perfect parallel. Like now we think Prohibition. What, they had Prohibition of alcohol? Like, that's insane, you know. And it's the same kind of thing. Like, what? They banned Ulysses for what, you know? But it happened at the exact same time. That's another big coincidence in, surrounding this Ulysses.
So well, that, you have yeah, to think that, of who was the audience for Ulysses? Who were they protecting? Who were they preventing from reading? I throw that out there, I guess, as a question at this point. Like, who would the typical reader of Ulysses be, and why would anyone want to prevent those people, that specific market or that specific demographic, from reading this book? Because it's not a book for the uneducated. I'm sorry, but it's not a book for the uneducated today. Why would that be any different 100 years ago?
Right. He had already had problems with his earlier works that he tried to put out. It's almost like he was already blacklisted as a kind of subversive, right? Like that Joyce is up to something. We don't know what, but let's ban it. You know, he's got some dirty words in there, you know. But
I mean, the parallels to Lenny Bruce, I think, are just so extreme, in that when you try to reconcile the image of Lenny Bruce from the obscenity trials and the drug addiction, and then you actually hear the words that he spoke, there's just a huge disconnect, because there's nothing obscene or it's that he just raises questions in a certain demographic that is dangerous. Right, you have upwardly mobile people who are becoming liberated financially and through the different jobs that are becoming available to them. And then this book comes in that attempts to trigger certain thought processes that threaten to dismantle the framework with which they've been elevated, right? Like the whole model of a sort of matrix of huge populations in very small urban centers depends on these certain structures in place to make sure that you always have a class system, right? Right. And there's a certain blindness and ignorance that's necessary so that the building doesn't topple, right? And I think that this book, you could attack it based on the sections that from top to bottom people might say are private or are not discussed in good company or base or too sexual, too perverted, or these everyday things where going to the bathroom or masturbation or infidelity. But it's really not that it's those topics that they want to suppress. It's that those topics in the midst of these thought processes that combine to trigger questions that the people in charge are not willing to or unable to answer. And that's my personal viewpoint on why it was condemned so swiftly. And then what a victory for it to be liberated in America. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. It's almost like what it is, Ulysses is a complete takedown or deconstruction of realism and naturalism. And so involved in that, like from a kind of McLuhan sense of it, is that it's a complete change of perception, right? Like so he's not... in Ulysses, he's not countering realism with fantasy, right? He's going deeply as far as possible into realism, and then twisting it and distorting it from within, really ripping it apart from within, turning it inside out. And like you said, that enters in a whole new wave of consciousness. Happened because of that, like not only Ulysses, but including the whole kind of modernist movement at that time. But I think Joyce was even ahead of his time in that group. You know, that it's almost like you said, it was like he was taking it down too quickly. He was changing the operating system too quickly, and we have to have to suppress this and sit on it for a few years to sort of assimilate it a bit.
Well, it's interesting in the like the mythology of what created Joseph Campbell himself. You know, I think it was his experience with James Joyce, and so it's like he gets Ulysses, and he's like, "How do you read this thing?" And then you know, like that's the thing that. I think it was actually Finnegan's Wake where, you know, before he discovered whatever, you know, his mythological structure or articulated what he, you know, his hero's journey, he first articulated a skeleton key to Finnegan's Wake. Like, I think that's the first thing that he did.
Yeah. The first, like, major book, anyway.
Yeah.
Like, and it, yeah, it's all about the monomyth, which he, like, his whole subsequent thought is the monomyth, which he takes directly from Finnegan's Wake. So you think about that, it's like, like that leads his work, Campbell's work leads into Star Wars directly. And then you look at the huge impact on popular culture that created, you know, it's like, it all comes back to June 16th, 1904, you know?
Well, what do you make of 2012 then? What did we enter into a new kind of consciousness? And you know, when that happens, when you inhabit a new paradigm, you can't, you know, the old paradigm's
hey,
gone.
Doug, before we go there, can I want to say this just before, and then I'll stop talking about it. But the Triest website, I just pulled it up, it lists the maximum depth that it went to at 10,911 meters. And then in the corner, it lists the coordinates and the like longitude, latitude directions, and it's 11 degrees 19 north, 142 degrees 15 east. So I don't know. And it's also 1019, but we can talk about 2012. I'm not going to bring up the tree sub again.
that's great. I think it's the same as it's similar to 1904, right? Like 1904 might have been the beginning of the cycle, but people weren't noticing it until 1922. You know. So 2012, everybody was waiting for this massive climax to occur, right? And it, when it didn't occur, everybody thought, no, this is just another bullshit date. But it's coming, you know. It's like we're just realizing the shockwaves now, you know. I wrote this piece about Crowley's Moonchild, where there's a part in Moonchild where he's talking about one of the characters in it is talking about taking a cone, like a three-dimensional cone, and putting the tip of the cone into a surface of water. And so the idea is that it's a three-dimensional object going into a two-dimensional space. Mm-hmm. And how that would look to like flatlanders on the surface of the water, right? And you wouldn't really notice it when it first hit. You would just—it would just be one point, and almost nobody would notice it. But you wouldn't notice it until afterwards, when all the waves are sort of rippling from it, radiating from it, and then the object gets bigger and bigger, right? And so I think with 2012, it was just the tip of the hyperdimensional object hit us, you know. And only now, and you can tell it now, it's just like everything is fake, you know. It's like fake upon fake upon fake, you know. Like nobody has any sense of what the hell's going on.
You know? Well, I think similarly, around that time that you wrote about that, didn't you make a McLuhan entry that had to do with the kaleidoscope?
Yeah.
The kaleidoscope, as it relates to Joyce, I think, is really interesting to consider. I mean, because, yeah, it's just churning.
Yeah, I think for Joyce, what the kaleidoscope means is that it's not history is not a linear progression. It's just a turn of the kaleidoscope, and some elements within history are subdued, and then some elements are enhanced. And as it turns, maybe those subdued elements will come up again, and then those enhanced elements will go into shadow, you know? Mm. So there's no... To say that we have progressed more than they were at in 1904, for example, is really not right in some sense, you know? It's like we've just... The kaleidoscope has turned, but in 1904, their impressions of reality was as vivid as ours is now, you know? And in every time, it's exactly the same. And so, when we go from Ulysses to Finnegan's Wake, he presents the entirety of history in one kaleidoscopic image that's turning constantly.
But what are their dimensions of coincidence and synchronicity in 1904? It's kind of flat, like a kaleidoscopic vision. It's not sort of the three-dimensional synchronistic globe that we have at our disposal right now.
I would say it's as multidimensional. Like I use kaleidoscope, but I don't consider it just to be two-dimensional. The metaphor of kaleidoscope works because it's saying that it exists at every point, you know. So so the kaleidoscope is kind of in my mind it's multidimensional. It's like a multidimensional kaleidoscope that has always existed throughout history.
I guess for me, you know, the phrase "I've been around the block a few times."
Right.
So that's someone who's sort of gone through the cycles of what life is, seen the highs and the lows, and kind of seen that we're pretty much orbiting the same thing. And you kind of get better at it, and you have a little bit more control over it each time. And so that sort of was a terminology for someone who had experienced what there is to experience. But it definitely seems that that is somewhat linear and flat. And I think that the whole confrontation of the fourth dimension is more about saying I've been outside the cube, right? That you haven't been around one side of the block, but you've been actually outside of the cube itself. And that you've seen experience as a hyperdimensional, in a hyperdimensional kind of category. And I think that's what the emergence of relativity is at the turn of the century, right? That people are starting to define experience through relativity. There is no truth, but within the forces of relativity, truths do emerge. I guess that's what – you have sort of Leopold Bloom where he's attacking Hamlet through algebra, right? He says that he's going to prove to you through algebra. He's not bringing up this sort of crackpot theory just out of the fantasies of his mind. He's actually applying acknowledged mathematics or science. Like, you can't deny my theory because it's rooted in something universal.
Well,
he's not the hero, right? He's the emergent genius, but Bloom has this softer relativity, right? He can appreciate other people's viewpoints. He can coexist with all types of people as a soft outsider that isn't, you know, he's an outsider in the house that isn't rejected or hated. I mean, he might be annoying, but he is allowed to exist. Maybe somewhere between Stephen and Leopold is that sort of fourth dimensional viewpoint that is emerging around that time.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, for me, I think the hyperdimensional object, it's not as if something new is coming into the system or into history. It's just the hyperdimensional object has always been here. It's just there are waves within history where we start to notice it, you know? There are individuals who notice it at any point in history, like visionaries or artists or mystics or whatever. But then there are certain times when whole cultures seem to become aware of it, you know? And I think that's what has been happening since 2012.
So the internet as a culture, right? The internet as a place, the internet as a country.
Bill, were one of the first people to point that out that I know of about the smartphones reaching, I think, 1 billion smartphones in use in 2012, you know?
Yeah.
And then the smartphone looking like a pocket monolith at that time, you know?
Yeah.
Not to say that everything about the smartphone is good, you know? Like when I ride the train, most people on their smartphones are looking through celebrity tweets and just totally inane stuff, you know? But again, it's like the medium is the message, right?
Before smartphones and before newspapers, where were people's daydreams on the train or when they were walking a great distance? Where does the mind wander to? I mean, how base and simplistic is the majority of the minutiae of people's thoughts? Or is that being hijacked by...
Well, I've been in Japan now long enough to see the sort of change on the trains, packed trains in Tokyo, from when the smartphone really hit, right? Like people always had cell phones, but people were doing texts on their cell phones and stuff like that, but you can't really spend a lot of time just on a normal cell phone. And so a lot of people were actually reading books on the train. And now there's like far fewer people reading books. And then I've talked to booksellers in Tokyo, and they say we're losing our customers, you know. That's one big change as well, right? So even within the space of 10 years, it's gone from a kind of a more literary culture to a more like a electronic culture based on who knows, like based on trivia or
Joyce. Yeah, that's what made me laugh when Bill said I hope I can read the Bible when I'm 65 or read Ulysses when I'm 65. I hope I can, my nervous system is oriented when I'm 65 so that I can actually sit and read a book still, like yeah. Because of the impact of, you know, I don't know. It's just, but yeah.
I went to Hamlet last night.
Oh, really? Wow. That's excellent. That's a great, did you plan that?
No.
For this?
No.
No. Oh, wow. Okay.
We even got rained out. We had tickets for last Sunday, but it rained out, and so we ended up at Hamlet last night. But to sit for that long on your ass in this hard plastic chair is just like, you know, that is asking something of our modern consciousness. You know, about intermission, it's like, all right, maybe that's enough. I mean, because, let's see, we started... I guess the show really didn't start until like 8 o'clock, but we were there until 11. I mean, it's a commitment to see a Shakespearean play. What was his theater or his theory though? What is Daedalus's theory about Hamlet?
Yeah, it gets all convoluted as well, right?
I couldn't follow.
But one thing Bill mentioned about his theory being algebra, and that's actually like a taunt by Buck Mulligan. He's kind of mocking Stephen by saying it's algebra. But then and then when Stephen actually he gets around to the point in the library of giving his theory, then nobody really understands what he's talking about. But it comes down to Shakespeare being a cuckold, you know, that Shakespeare was involved with Anne Hathaway and he had to leave and he might have been cuckolded by his own brothers. And he's referring to that all the way through his plays. I think he had a brother Richard and a brother Edward, and then all these characters, like even like Richard III or something. When Shakespeare's talking about him, it's like this evil king. It's like his brother who stole his girl. So that's part of it, right? That's part of it. But he's also talking about Hamlet, yeah. And I haven't seen Hamlet for a long time, so it's not really fresh in my mind, but it's like, so you have the ghost that appears to Hamlet, who's Hamlet's father.
Right. Yeah.
And, so there again, there's this theme of the ghostly father, like the father who isn't there, and then the father and then the son being one, and then, so the son not being there for the father. And then Shakespeare himself had this son called Hamnet, who died at the age of 11, in the same way that Leopold Bloom's son died at 11 days. So it's, there's this big theme all the way through that, like Leopold is a cuck, you know, like the alt-right people are spewing all the time, you know, like everybody's a cuck, you know, he is a cuckold, you know, but as you get into Ulysses, it's almost like what he's saying is that any creator, any artist, especially every male artist, is a cuckold, because the artist is able to create because of the muse, who's the goddess, but then so maybe the artist becomes famous, and then the artist thinks, wow, I've created this amazing piece of art, and then his fame goes away or whatever, and something else comes out, and somebody else gets the muse, right? And so the last artist becomes cuckolded by the muse, right? And so then at the very end of Ulysses, Bloom is talking about how there is no start and there's no end to the series of suitors that Molly has. And Molly being the muse, she's had all of these artists who have kind of tapped into her and used her as this creative power. And in the history of writing in the West, usually it's been unacknowledged. But then this return back to the muse, it's like this re-acknowledgement that's where it comes from. It's the goddess, or in Finnegan's Wake, it's the river, and that's where it comes from. It's the yes, you know, like Molly Bloom's yes at the end. That's where creative power comes from. So in a way, it's like every father is a son, every son is a father, but fatherhood in itself is inadequate without the fertile mother, like the mother of the imagination.
This sounds like a lovely religion that you're spelling out for us. I think that the text is just too complicated for the laity. We're going to have to work on the missals, I suppose.
Do you want to, we could get more into the text. So you haven't talked about what part that you like the best, Doug.
Oh, I did. The part where the language was so dramatically expressive.
The hospital scene.
Yeah.
Okay.
But at times, so it's funny because I did not read. I was in my early 20s. I had a copy of Ulysses, and I thought this is something that I should read. And that was kind of the time when I was reading a lot of different things that I thought I should read. And I still...
Oh, young Dougie. Just...
I still...
hands on it.
Behave that way. It's like, well, this is a book that I know I should probably read. So...
Yeah.
But at that time, man, I could not... I don't know how deep I got into that thing. And it's like, I don't know what's going on at all. I don't know at all. You know, it's like, you lost me after we started... You know, we had this bowl of shaving cream, and then I was lost, completely lost. I may have read 40 pages, I might have read 80 pages, but, and then I never touched it again. And so this time, the interesting thing was is that I chose not to read any type of guides before. Mm. But about halfway through the thing, I'm like, I wonder what the hell's going on. And so then I went to Wikipedia and I was just looking at basic plot summaries. And it's like, you know, I guess I was getting all that. You know, for the most part, I had a sense of this. When it leapt into like dream spaces, that's, yeah, those were times when I was like, yeah, I'm not sure what's going on. I thought I knew, but so like the plot summaries will say, they have a hallucination together or something like this. And so like, yeah, I was following, but of course I wasn't following because, you know, reality broke down at that point.
Yeah, I think that's what's meant to happen.
But it's strange because I think it could become more fun the more I felt like I had a sense. So like at Shakespeare last night, you know, I'm so familiar with Hamlet that it didn't seem like the language itself was a barrier between me and the meaning. You know, this was just the medium of the thing, and that was kind of the fun of it. And so I think that they could be the same with this, with Ulysses.
Sure.
Yeah.
When you were watching Hamlet, did Ulysses spring out at you at any point?
No, because that's my own. I mean, I was resonating really hard with Hamlet about 2012, actually. Like, that was...
Oh. Well.
Yeah.
Let's hear that.
Well, I mean, it's just this... He's obsessed, and he's unwilling... You know, like, he knows he needs to do something, but he's just not doing anything. Or he's just obsessing about doing something. Like, clearly his father wants him to revenge the situation, but he wants to have it both ways, you know?
Right. And how are you tying that to 2012?
I don't know if that's more personal. I just, that was the story that I was really resonating with. You know, that was the lens that I was looking through.
Are you saying like people who were obsessing about what was going to happen in 2012 but not actually actively trying to make something happen?
Yeah, maybe.
That's interesting, yeah.
Maybe it the age that I was at, I felt like I needed to like do something, become something with my life. You know, so, but I really wasn't, you know, like the play's the thing to catch the conscience of the king. It's like I needed some kind of ploy to be able to harness the message that I felt like I had at that point in time, which was, you know, this kind of, for me, there was this kind of, you know, the politics and the environmental, you know, it just felt like everything was kind of coming to it. You know, it felt like we were moving towards doomsday.
Right.
Not Bloomsday.
Well, that's another pun.
Oh, okay. Yeah?
Well, at one point he's, when they're talking about the, when they're talking about the Hades episode, when he goes to the cemetery, and it gets written up afterwards. The obituary gets written up afterwards. And then in the obituary, it talks about the visitors. And, of course, one of them was Leopold Bloom. But they spelled it L Boom. So Bloomsday is Boomsday, which is doomsday, you know? Like, it's the day everything goes boom. Yeah. No, it's No, it's interesting. I really think that stuff like this, like Hamlet and Ulysses and all these major works of literature, like even more recent stuff like Infinite Jest, although I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I think all of these amazing pieces of literature are really tapping into this timeless thing, you know, that this that sort of it's as if the actual year or the actual place when these novels occur, or even movies when they occur, they're just like costumes, you know, the costumes that can be removed, and then other costumes that you can put on. But basically, they're all tapping into this one point, you know, that a lot of people associated with 2012. I think I don't know if it's a problem, but a lot of people were expecting some external thing to happen, like some dramatic thing to happen at that point, to kind of justify all the concern that they placed in 2012. And then when it didn't, a lot of people got really kind of cynical about things. But it's almost as if that moment, it's happening every moment, you know, it's happening at every point. Every day is a Bloomsday, right?
It's too bad, because part of the synchronicity movement, if you want to call it that, is built on this forward looking. There was something about the idea, I mean, that kind of took hold with the Terrence McKenna Time Wave Zero thing, and also a little bit of the, oh, what is his name? You know, some of the AI stuff, whatever that guy, I can't think of his name is. It seems like these two things came together, like all this, like this religious stuff, and it was really interesting, but it gave lives meaning, it gave people stuff to talk about, but then it also let people be open to these kind of topics in a way that we normally aren't open, and it just created a moment to really explore really exciting and people made really fascinating work. And then after 2012, it just seems like, you know, the synchronicity gates were kind of shut off. Like, well, that,
yeah, exactly.
That didn't happen. Yeah. And so now let's move on to the next thing, which is, you know, what?
Alt-right bullshit. that's what it turns out to be.
National. You know? Well, we need to believe in something. And so I believe in the personal identity of my physical body.
Right. Yeah, and my tribe and my nation and so on, you know. Exactly, that's what happened, you know. That's why I think that it's kind of like Ulysses, and especially Finnegan's Wake, is kind of like a way to counter that, you know, a way to like we've been saying all along, a way to realize that it's happening all the time. Like that sense of kind of wonder, or that sense that anything could happen in the time leading up to 2012, right? That should still be here, you know? It is still here, you know? That hasn't really changed, you know? The only thing that's changed is that our attention has been put off of it.
I feel like you both just hit on something that I wanted to talk about anyways, and maybe 2012 was a little bit too much of looking for one singular thing and to change everything, as which is sort of a mirror of like a savior type moment. And right. I think one thing that comes up in Ulysses is sort of that golden bough type scapegoat conversation. Zenor, the idea of a scapegoat, is that something that you thought of at all,
how
does that fit in here?
Yeah, I've actually got this this book on the Golden Bough, and talking about its influence on a lot of modernist authors, including Joyce, and that that's all the way through Ulysses, the Golden Bough, you know.
Yeah,
And definitely Bloom is the scapegoat, obviously. Like he's the wandering Jew. Like that's another one of his incarnations. Like he's Odysseus, but then there's also there's a theory out there that Odysseus wasn't even Greek. He was Semitic as well, like possibly Jewish, you know. So he's the wandering Jew, and then the Jews all the way through history have been used as a scapegoat. And then the underlying anti-Semitism that he faces all the way, and sometimes really overt, you know, all the way through his day, you see that seething behind the surface, right? And the sense that people are down and out, and they've got to blame it on somebody or some group of people, and the Jews are out there as the scapegoat to turn to when everything else fails, you know, like that. They're like the fallback scapegoat, you know, and that's another parallel to right now, you know. It's like this kind of rise of anti-Semitism, like behind the New World Order are the Jews, you know.
I thought that you and David's conversation in that AR a long time ago was really, really poignant, how it addressed that historically.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Just vaguely. I don't remember what I was saying, what he was saying about it.
It doesn't maybe need to be completely rehashed or anything. It's just.
It's obvious that's there. You know, it's. Like it's so easy to. And this is a conclusion that Ezra Pound made, who was editing Ulysses, like. After Pound came to that conclusion as well, as like, how did the horror of World War I happen, and then the depression, the worldwide depression that followed, and then he's like, it's because of this system of usury that exists internationally.
Yeah, then, you mentioned that in that blog, and that how Pound actually was identifying with more of a classically fascist belief system. Mussolini.
He became a full supporter of Mussolini, right? Which is, it's such a turn from Joyce, who's like, politically, he's like, Joyce is an anarchist, kind of like a individualist anarchist. And then Pound's whole take on it, and they're coming from exactly the same point, exactly from this avant-garde point of thinking that the creative individual is essential, you know, like that sort of Blake's idea that you have to create your own system of the imagination, or you're going to get sucked into somebody else's, right? And so they take that point, this kind of individualist anarchist, full power to the imagination perspective, and then Pound, through that, he thinks that the whole usurious international banking system is sort of hampering those flows of life, right? The exact same flows of life that Joyce is talking about all the way through Ulysses. Like, that's the yes, you know, the final yes at the end of it. That's being blocked and then tapped by this system of usury and projected into this evil system, right? And so Pound taps into that, like he finds out about that, and then he makes this false jump, this jump that's out there for us all to fall into, this trap that because there are so many Jews historically involved in the banking system, that it's a Jewish conspiracy, which he should have known from reading Ulysses is complete bullshit, you know? Like, there are Jewish bankers, but not all bankers are Jews, you know.
That's, as you were talking about that, it really reminded me of this sort of corollary moment right now of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and Ethereum and a number of other ones, or some of the other ones are interesting too, but like this is the contemporary workaround of that same moment potentially, or I don't know. Maybe nothing ever changes. Maybe this is the same moment.
Those cryptocurrencies, they demo. Well, I forget the name of one that's based on. It's based on the system where it, if you hold on to it, it decreases in value. So, it has to continue to circulate, or else it loses its value. And this was directly based on this this anarchist in Germany around 1918 in the kind of Bavarian Revolution there, that pound was really into, right?
Oh, really? I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah, I'm spacing his name and actually the name of the cryptocurrency right now, but yeah, I'll look it up after. But that's the whole thing. Like Pound himself, and a lot of these people who were into fascism at that time, obviously they didn't know where fascism would go to, you know? So he was interested because he thought that Mussolini could crack down on this banking system and create what Pound wanted is debt-free money, right?
Yeah.
And he actually thought Mussolini would go through with that. And Pound approached everybody. Like, he went to the American government, he tried to get them involved. He went to Stalin, he tried to get Stalin involved. And then he thought the best way forward is through Mussolini. And obviously that didn't work either, you know?
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, that reminds me, you do such a great job with images in your blog. Because I'm immediately reminded of the Mussolini image that you used there, which is his eyes and that downward seppuku or whatever you call it.
He looks like a big egg.
Yeah, he looks like a big egg. It's like almost like the Sergeant Pepper's Crowley picture, and
yeah,
like
exactly.
The whites of his eyes is all on the top. You know, like
great.
Yeah, that's a great image.
The world egg. Bill, you just came back, or were you off?
I just disconnected for like 20 seconds, but okay. I got back on.
Let's hear from you.
Oh, no, I'm enjoying it. I really love the Blake concept of creating your own system of imagination. Yeah. Which to me ties in with the art of memory, which ties in with the whole construction of some sort of scaffolding in your psyche so that you can elevate these correspondences into the requisite epiphany, right? Into that nuclear fission that you need to break through and have the vision of, or sort of that anamnesis, which is remembering, right? Mm. Is remembering where and when and who you are, which I think is essential, but I guess also isolating. I think Joyce felt very isolated in his awareness, right?
Sure.
I read there's a book that details the letters between, it's the letters between Ezra Pound and James Joyce. And kind of boring.
yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, that's his letter writing style is very kind of officious, almost. Pound sounds like some sort of evil redneck or something, right? But Joyce is like, it's like he getting a letter from an accountant or something.
Yeah, very. Like he was hungover, right?
Yeah.
Like, shit. Gotta get food. Gotta get clothes. Let me write Ezra. This is where I'm at. I gotta get some dough. You know, we'll get you some clothes. We'll get you some money. And so, you know, Ezra's salivating at this genius in a stable, and Joyce is sort of like, oh yeah, I can tap on Ezra's shoulder. Who else was he tapping, you know, on the shoulder? But it was really just. Highly disappointing in its content, those letters. But, you know, Joyce was really just a survivor. You know, he was like that woman in labor, right? He had, or at least he had convinced himself of that. I'm sure that he probably I mean, if you ran into Joyce, where they said his shoes were two sizes too small, his clothes were tattered because he had one suit. I mean, he was, by superficial standards, just a bum.
And then, how many eye operations did he go through during the writing of Finnegan's Wake? You know, it's like, and then meanwhile, his daughter is going insane. You know, it's a hard life.
Frank Delaney recounts the one time that Ezra Pound and James Joyce met, and it was at some sort of fancy event, and James Joyce didn't have any nice clothes for it, and they thought this was going to be some sort of big meeting of the minds, and they both like just complained about their ailments, like Pound his stomach and Joyce's eyes, and then they like and Pound like wanted to talk about various like rich people, and he like wanted, and I guess Joyce made a joke later that he wanted to talk about various officials, and Joyce just wanted to talk about chambermaid, blowing the quote, but yeah. It was a funny still they're talking about their physical ailments, which is interesting because we're talking about people with interesting sensory. I mean, I think they have, I mean, they are feeling in they're feeling things in a unique way, like both their exterior world as well as their interior world, and then the whole eye thing, very symbolic.
Totally. Like, and the fact that Joyce and his father, like Stephen Dedalus and his father, were singers. Like, Joyce almost went into a career as a tenor. You know, his singing voice was apparently really good, and so all the way through Ulysses, like all of his stuff, actually, it's tuned to the ear. You know, especially Finnegan's Wake, it's meant to be read aloud. But even Ulysses, I'd say as well, it's musical. So yeah, then you have that split all the way through his work of the ear and the eye, which McLuhan picks up on. You know.
Yeah.
Can I ask which audio versions you guys? I think there's lots of various audio versions, but do you know? Yes.
Yeah, the one I like is. One I like is what is it? The Irish Public Radio one, which is I think what is that called? RTE is the. I really, really like that one. Especially that quote that you read at the beginning, Doug, about Mr. Leopold Bloom. Yeah, talking about nutty gizzards, and it's excellent. Yeah.
Well, that's why I mean I would say urine, but.
Yeah, urine. Yeah.
Urine, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine was narrated by the Donnelly guy. I don't know. Is that the same as yours, Doug? Wait, what? Who?
I'll tell you in a sec.
I got mine through Audible. And,
me
I'm not
too.
Really sure. Yeah, I'm not really sure who it is that narrates it, but he does a fine job.
Yeah.
And it has a woman reading the 18th chapter, which I thought was a nice touch.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. This one, this Irish audio one, has that as well, the Irish radio. It's, yeah, RTE, that's right. It's the best one if you can find it. I think I downloaded it from somewhere, Pirate Bay or something like that. It's excellent. Like there's all kinds of different actors, so it's all kinds of different voices.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel in any regard that Ulysses is fading out of focus as we get further and further away from Dublin of 1904, and that Finnegan's Wake is becoming more and more focused? Alternatively.
Yeah. That's a great question, because that's what I thought, you know. That's what I thought up until reading it again, just over the last month or so, you know. But then reading Ulysses again, it's just this isn't a time piece at all, you know. It's not a time based piece. It's still as alive as it was, or as alive as Finnegan's Wake, you know. Even though it is kind of like a historical novel, and especially when you watch movies, like you, I don't know if you guys have seen any of the kind of film versions of Ulysses.
Oh,
and
no.
they kind of portray it as like a, the way they portray it on film is like what you said, Bill. It's kind of like a, like time based, you know. It's like a, it looks like some Victorian novel or something, right? But when you actually read it, read the text, read the book, it's like it's timeless, you know. It still is timeless.
But there's just all these flavors and sensations in the notes of the songs that are floating through their heads, and the sounds of the street, and the sounds of the shoes, and the sounds of the carriages, and the sounds of the bars that just don't exist anymore, right? Simply, we don't have that tactile relationship with them anymore. Right. And so you really have like a piece of fruit or a piece of something seasoned, that seasoning is just, it's faded and disappeared. We can project onto it our own personal experiences, but the actual punch of the flavor is gone. And I really believe if it is rooted in that sort of occult knowledge of the art of memory, or I think of Crowley's 777, yeah, you know, these indexes of correspondences, that there's something powerfully local about the painstaking approach of the actuality of it. I mean, there's value in its removal. Like if someone has read the Odyssey, right, they can then jump into Ulysses and have an understanding of it, right? And so that's a timeless portal into Ulysses. But again, that Dubliner, that person who knew that actual 4x4 mile space, those people, those smells, those roads, you know, that is slowly and maybe now almost absolutely disappeared.
Bill, that's interesting that you bring that up, because isn't one of the critiques of Homer's Odyssey that the description of color indicates that people maybe didn't have a sense for certain colors?
There's some
wine dark.
Yeah, the wine dark sea. Yeah. Yeah. Which in Ulysses they make fun of it and call it the snot green sea.
Well, yeah. Well, isn't he using the color green to poke fun at not only the nationalist Irish sentiment, but also the Buck Mulligan is an actual person he knew. It's not the same name, but it starts with a G.
Oliver Gogarty.
Yeah, Gogarty.
He's making fun of Stephen's dirty handkerchief that he uses to wipe off his razor with, and Stephen never washes anything, so his hanky is snot green. So they're on the top of the tower. He's doing like a kind of black mass with his razor as part of the cross, and then he's using his hanky to wipe it, looking at the snot green sea. But yeah, what you said is about Homer's.
Yeah, what do you?
I've heard that. I've heard that too. That the perception of color is different, because who now would describe the sea as being the wine dark sea? Yeah.
So that's interesting, Bill. Things may be sensory, going in and out of focus or losing your connection to it. Yeah.
But this time I saw it as like that's what I thought too. But again, there's the external, there's all the external stuff, the naturalistic stuff, which he tries to get as realistic as possible. And then there's all the internal stuff that's going on. And that stuff, I think, doesn't change, you know. Like you will always find somebody like Bloom having those same thoughts, you know, like the part when Bloom is searching for a place to fart, you know, I've been there so many times, you know, I see myself in his like internal monologue constantly, you know, and with Stephen too, like not to the same extent, you know, because he's so intellectual, right? But with Bloom, I think he's still relatable. Like he will always be relatable in that way, because I think he really tapped into how the internal world works in a certain way. Would you agree with that, Bill? Or?
I feel that in a system of correspondences, the more breaks you have and the deeper and longer the breaks, you don't get that transmission that you're looking for. I imagine that for someone who had been away from Dublin or someone who had lived in Dublin, the transmission of correspondences could probably be overwhelming to a degree, with the inner monologues, the thoughts, and coupled with all the details. And then mentioning advertisements, mentioning songs sung in church. And so all the floods of memories that are connected to those pointed objects that fill the reader's head as they're going through this day, there's millions of tiny abysses that fill with actual experience that we don't have access to. So we're basically looking at maybe a 15-inch black and white TV, whereas someone could be watching 3D IMAX. You know what I mean? There is a disconnection that is just very tactile. But Joyce knew that maybe he was – so if 100 years from now, people wouldn't have access to that, right? If maybe 99% of the world's population wouldn't have access to that, then why take all the time and energy to put that in there if one person out of 10 million will actually have access to it? That seems silly, right? What's the point of devoting all that time and energy for that one element that's going to be inaccessible? But that is sort of like the hidden variable, right? That's the one thing that actually has tied the whole book together. That's the word made flesh, right? That maybe dies and resurrects or something. Like, that's the transubstantiate. Like, he's working on that sort of he has the faith that this is this is necessary, that this is, even if no one even sees it, this is going to bind everything together into what I'm trying to create.
The other thing too is that he's publishing this book in 1922. Some of it came out before that in series, right? But it's all about 1904, so it's already anachronistic in a way. It's already dated. Mm-hmm. So it's almost he's purposely dating it, I think, to do what you're suggesting. It's like he wants to include as much detail in that particular date and in that particular year and that particular place, just so that it does become every place and every time, because he wants us to pay as much attention to this exact moment that we're in right now as he did in Ulysses to June 16th, 1904.
When is the Easter Uprising in Irish history?
That's I think it's 1916.
Right, and so the publication of Ulysses is post Easter Uprising.
Yeah.
Which is the independence, right, of Ireland?
Yeah.
So that has to be like, okay, so you have this whole wave of intention of the Irish to gain their independence, and you have that on the minds of certain characters, but then Leopold Bloom in his day-to-day activities is more concerned about meat pies and the infidelity of his wife and his memories, right? So you have this – it would seem that you have this united Ireland, right, this united force that is struggling for this independence, but really life is so much more diaphanous, right? If is that the word, that it there's so much space, and that these that human life exists within these great historical waves, but you know, it doesn't even necessarily concern Bloom all that much.
Right. Except you read from his own thoughts that when he was younger, he was really himself. He was really involved in the Irish nationalist movement, like in Sinn Féin. And that's one of the reasons why he thought he was treated so unjustly by the citizen or the Cyclops. He said he himself was an Irish, like a radical Irish nationalist at one point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
how does he lose that? Does he mention that?
I don't know. With becoming a father, and especially after losing his son, he that kind of fades away. But and I think his perspective changed too. Like he was, like he's never into violence, right? And I think his perspective changed in the same way that Joyce's perspective changed, is that nationalism was too limited a scope. Like when Bloom's spinning off in the Night Town episode, and he's envisioning his perfect world, the new Blue Muslim or whatever he calls it, right?
Yeah.
He thinks that is universal, right? It's not national, right? He does see himself as this hero of Ireland, but then it goes beyond that to the whole world that he's saving. And then in the next moment he's turned into a pig and he's being ridden by some whore mistress. Yeah.
That's such a wild part. That's so crazy.
But I see what you're saying, Bill, about like Finnegan's Wake. Like Finnegan's Wake is so the way it's constructed is that it will continue to be contemporary because it develops its own meaning continually. Like all the time you can find new puns in it that directly relate to what's going on at the moment, you know. You can find Trump in Finnegan's Wake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I agree with that. And he's doing that on purpose too. Joyce is doing that on purpose. It's like he's tapped into the muse so deeply that his works have become works of prophecy. Not of his own prophecy, but prophecy, they generate their own prophecy.
Yeah.
And he does that by just tying so many elements together, you know. And it reminds me of what people are doing with Sync, you know, like especially leading up to 2012, where everybody was looking into the significance of absolutely everything, and everything was connecting. All people were having these like sync orgasms, and then that was melding into everybody else's. You know, it's like so. That's what's going on in Finnegan's Wake. You know, it's like as Umberto Eco said, it's like a machine that Joyce has created that will continue to work beyond the life of its author. You know, it continues to generate new meaning, and it will continue to generate new meaning. It's the same with that Philip K. Dick talked about it as well.
Absolutely.
But in a way, I don't even think it's Finnegan's Wake anymore. You know, it's like Finnegan's Wake is just like or Ulysses or Joyce in general. It's like that's a portal onto whatever this thing is. You know, the I think McKenna's term, like the hyperdimensional object or whatever. That's always there. You know, and it's like Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses leading up to it is the best window into that almost. But once you look through that window, it's like everything turns into that afterwards. You know, everything becomes a window after that.
Zenor, didn't you mention that there was a Crowleyan ritual in New York at was that the day that the book was released, or was that just another June 16th sync?
That was.
Do you remember?
It was being serialized. Ulysses was being serialized at the exact time that Crowley was living in New York. Like serialized.
Oh yeah.
From a magazine in New York called The Little Review, at the exact same time that Crowley was living in New York and doing that whole working that where he contacted that that entity Lamb.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
That was happening within blocks of each other. Like the Little Review was getting released, and it probably, I would say almost undoubtedly that Crowley was, if he had the money, he was buying the Little Review and reading Ulysses. You know.
Yeah.
He was such a fan of Joyce, anyways. But that whole period, I think it's so crucial, you know. It's so necessary to understand Joyce, of course, but all of those guys, you know, and women as well, you know. It's like Gertrude Stein or something. Like that whole scene, you know, that whole scene is really important to understanding what's going on now, you know.
It's funny because there's a character named Lynch, and you know, there's the new Twin Peaks thing, and then in the Mark Frost book, Secret History of Twin Peaks, it's talking back about Jack Parsons and stuff. Like, it's just, it's all these things circled to the same points. It's very, very funny.
Yeah. No, it'd be fun to talk to Alex about this too, with his whole take on Crowley, because I think that, his take on Kubrick, because that taps right into it too. Especially even that quote I read earlier by Richard Ellman, how Joyce thought there are a certain set of numbers that keep reappearing, you know?
Yeah.
Joyce's set of numbers is slightly different than, but I think related to what Alex is into as well. Especially Joyce's big thing is 22, of course, because he's born on February the 2nd. And he was 22 in 1904 on June 16th. And 16-6 is also 22. It's supposed to be something that wrote Anton Wilson pointed out, is that like the first is it the first sentence that has 22 words in it?
Oh wow!
But I think it's to me it's like this massive kind of mystery that what all these guys were up to at that time, like especially all these modernists, a lot of them influenced by Yeats. Of course, Yeats and Crowley were both involved in the Golden Dawn. So it's a matter of like how much of all this stuff was intentional, how much of it was just independent artists having these massive creative breakthroughs. Like around the same time, like you have Eliot with The Wasteland, which is just revolutionary. And then Pound's coming out with the Cantos, which is the same, you know. It's like people like Lawrence coming up with equally as incredible works, you know. So something at that point, like especially that year, even 1922, it's like there's something massive happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about 1947, and I think like 22 was like equally as important, or maybe even more so, and it led up to whatever happened in 47. I should be quiet a bit and let somebody else spew off.
No.
I'm actually fading.
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, I'm the only one who's got daylight, probably.
Yeah.
But this was
this is one of those conversations where I'd love to continue too, but I've been sick the last couple of days and I should probably sleep at some point.
Well, I need to say congratulations to Bill if you've completed your education. Is that correct?
Yeah, man. I finished grad school, got my teaching certificate. I started teaching summer school this week, and I start teaching full-time in the fall. So
wow.
Got the whole thing lined up, man.
You got a full-time position already,
yeah.
Already set up? That's excellent. That's great.
Yeah, fantastic. It's insane. I got it.
It's a rare thing these days.
Yeah, right. I got the job like 5 weeks into my student teaching. It was insane. Which my cooperating teacher and my professor, like, that never happens.
And so, what are you teaching?
Math.
Wow. Okay.
I'm teaching Algebra 1.
That's why you brought up algebra.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of like it's this framework, this scaffolding to teach a way of thinking. And there's this objective center that you're trying to get to, but there's subjective. There's many different ways to approach getting to that center. And it's going to be fascinating to learn how all these young people think and how they approach it. But I am the luckiest person on the planet right now. Just can't tell you how I can't believe that someone is allowing me the opportunity to do this. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'd like to join your class. I could brush up on my algebra.
The math, it's funny. Mathematics is hinted at and sort of the underlying bedrock of all synchronicity is, you know, what are the odds? What are the chances? And all the mechanics of mathematics are available to us to very, very high levels. And yet very few in the sync community seem to really take a traditional pathway into the mathematics, right? Mm. To get on that road to the actual quantum physical formulas. And I suspect that if one did spend 10 years studying those pathways, the epiphanies would be just as enormous and maybe just as frustrating, because you wouldn't be able to explain it to most of the people that you surround yourself with. But I mean, at least getting people into the doorway will be a challenge and rewarding, I imagine. I'm hoping.
Yeah, you might be able to work Hamlet into it somehow.
Yeah, right? Which is funny, because that whole Stephen Dedalus riff on Hamlet is just so sync community that it's not even funny.
But that's the whole thing. It's like this is sync before sync. You know, it's a direct lineage. Like it is a direct lineage through people like Robert Anton Wilson. You know.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was so funny about getting into the synchromistic community. It was sort of like, holy shit, it wasn't that it was new. It was just that there was this pool of emergent people, and they had a name for it. And it's like, I've been doing this for years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And for it to emerge out of the internet was just one of the greatest things that ever happened.
Yes.
That's why we're sitting here talking right now.
Amen, brother.
Yeah.
All right, I gotta go to bed, but I sure enjoy talking to you guys. And
yeah,
thanks for setting this up, Doug.
Yeah, exactly. That's excellent. I was totally looking forward to it, and it was as good as I hoped.
Awesome.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
All right, I'll keep you on the email chain, and if you feel like joining the next one, we'd love to have you again.
Long Florida. Adios, fellas.
See ya.
You guys. Bye-bye. Talk to you later.
Shipless. Bye now.
I did all my best to smile till your singing eyes and fingers drew me loving to your eyes. and you sang, sail to me, sail to me, let me enfold you. Here I am, here I am, waiting to hold you. Did I dream you dreamed about me? Were you here? Boat is leaning, broken love lull on your rocks. Before you sing, touch me not, touch me not, come back tomorrow. Oh, my heart, oh, my heart, shies from the sorrow. Well, I'm as puzzled as the newborn child. I'm as riddled as the tide. Should I stand amid the breakers, or should I lie with death my bride? Oh, hear me sing, swim to me, swim to me, let me enfold you. Here I am, here I am, waiting to hold.